Welcome back. This is the final installment of our book, Jackie and Me. This is chapter 16, Eat and Run. Jackie had a single and a double in game six, and he was in high spirits afterward. He knew I would be going back home after game seven, so he offered to take me out for a farewell dinner. Mrs. Robinson and Jackie Jr. joined us, and we went to a place called Frank's in Harlem. I was the only white person in the restaurant, but nobody said anything about it. The food was great. When we got back to the Robinsons' apartment, Jackie took out his key to open the door, but the door was already open. "Jack," Mrs. Robinson said anxiously, "somebody broke in." "I'll go and look around," he told her. "You stay out here." We waited on the sidewalk for a few minutes. Mrs. Robinson had a worried look on her face the whole time. Finally, Jackie emerged from the apartment. "Nothing is missing," he said. "I guess we must have left the door open when we left." That's when I realized what might be missing. I dashed inside with Jackie, Rachel, and Jackie Jr. right behind me. I tore open the door of the front closet and looked through it frantically. "My suitcase!" I shouted. "It's gone." The Robinsons assured me that the suitcase and anything inside it could be replaced. I knew it wasn't true. That suitcase had the last of the bond bread cards. They were priceless. I was furious. It had to be Aunt. It just had to be. The phone rang and Jackie picked it up. He listened for about a minute and said only two words, "How soon?" before hanging up. "Who was that, Jack?" Mrs. Robinson asked. "A friend at the police station," he said, looking at me. "He told me the cops are on their way over. Somebody called and gave them an anonymous tip that I kidnapped a white boy." "Aunt," I shouted, "I'll bet he took my suitcase too. I'll kill him." "No, you won't," Jackie said, grabbing me by the shoulders. "You never back down from anybody," I complained. "Why do you want me to?" "Stosh," he said calmly. "You're emotional, like me. You like to fight back." "Well, sometimes I don't fight back. I have sat in the back of buses so whites could sit up front. I've eaten sandwiches outside while my teammates ate the best food in a fancy restaurant. I've slept in seedy hotels while the rest of my team stayed in the nicest place in town. I've held back my fist when I wanted to hit somebody with it. I did that because some acts show courage. Others show stupidity. You've got to pick and choose your battles. You're not going to win this one." The doorbell rang. Mrs. Robinson peeked through the curtains. "It's the police," she whispered, then shouted, "I'll be right there." "Stosh," Jackie said to me, "you've got to go now." "But I want to be there for game seven," I begged. "And I want my suitcase back." "No," Jackie said firmly. Rachel picked up a pillow and put it on one side of the couch. I took my Griffey card out of my pocket and lay down. I thought about going home to Louisville. It took a few seconds, but soon the tingling sensation was there. "Good luck tomorrow," I told Jackie. "Thanks, Stosh. The guys will miss you." There was an insistent knock at the door. That was the last thing I remembered. Chapter 17, A Present. The first thing I did when I woke up at home was to reach for the baseball encyclopedia. I flipped to the section that gives the results for every World Series and turned the pages until I found 1947. The Dodgers lost Game 7. The Yankees were the world champions. If I had been there, would I have been able to make a difference? Could I have tipped off one of the Dodger hitters so he'd hit a home run? Could I have taught one of the pitchers how to throw a split-finger fastball or some other new pitch that hadn't been invented in 1947? Probably not. "Aren't you going to call your father and tell him you're home?" Mom asked once she finished hugging, kissing, and feeding me. The thought of meeting Dad terrified me. I knew he was going to ask about the suitcase he'd given me to fill with baseball cards. I knew he was going to hit the roof when I told him that for the second time, I didn't bring it back with me. It didn't matter. Mom left a message on Dad's answering machine telling him I was home. Dad rushed over as soon as he heard it. "Did you bring back the baseball cards?" he asked excitedly as soon as we were alone in my room. He knew right away from the look on my face that I had not. "I asked you to do one simple thing," he fumed, throwing his hands toward the ceiling in exasperation. "Fill a lousy suitcase with cards, then come back with it. Is that so hard? Is that too much to ask? But no, you come back with nothing." "The suitcase was stolen," I said quietly. "I'm sorry, but I did come back with something." I reached into my pocket and pulled out the scorecard Babe Ruth had signed for me. This is what it said: "To my pal, Bill Stoshak, from Babe Ruth." Dad's fingers trembled, as if he were holding $1 million in his hand. But for a moment or two, I felt Dad wasn't thinking about money. Chapter 18, Lessons. Mrs. Levitt was not overly thrilled with the oral reports from Black History Month, and she let us know it. I had to admit, they were pretty boring. I almost fell asleep in the middle of George Washington Carver. Finally, it was my turn. "Mr. Stoshak, you selected Jackie Robinson. What books, magazines, and other research materials did you use to do your report?" Research materials? I didn't use any research materials. I went back in time and met the guy. I used baseball cards," I admitted. Some of the kids laughed. "So tell us, Joe, what did you learn about Jackie Robinson?" "I learned what it must be like to be hated because of the color of your skin." "Explain, Joe." "Well, you see, I only picked Jackie Robinson because I love sports. I thought that studying him might help me learn how to hit the curveball or make the double play. But he taught me a lot more than that." Jackie Roosevelt Robinson was born in Cairo, Georgia, in 1919. He was the youngest of five children. When he was just 6 months old, his father abandoned the family. His mother, Mally, raised and supported all the children by herself. Jackie's brother, Mac, was a championship sprinter, and he finished second to Jesse Owens in the 200-meter dash at the 1936 Olympics. "I didn't know that," Mrs. Levitt said. While he was growing up, Jackie experienced segregation and discrimination, like all African Americans did at the time. But when he became the first Black man to play in the big leagues since 1887, it was much worse. While his team was on the road, he had to stay in separate hotels that admitted Black people. He had to eat in separate restaurants. Other teams refused to play if he was on the field. Some of his own teammates refused to speak to him. His wife, Rachel, would rub Jackie's sore legs at night because the trainers didn't want to touch his skin. On the field, players would intentionally spike him. They would throw fastballs at his head. They would curse him out. Fans threatened to kill him and his family. This didn't take place in ancient times or during slavery. I'm talking about the middle of the 20th century in America, where the Constitution states that all men are created equal. Jackie could have retaliated. He could have charged the mound and started fights, busted heads. That would have been his natural reaction. But he didn't. He answered with silence and self-control. He answered with dignity. And he answered by being a great player, despite everything he had to endure. Instead of fighting back with his fists, he fought back by showing how good he was. And because he was so good, many of the people who hated him and all other African Americans came to respect him and like him. That's what I learned about Jackie Robinson. You got all that from baseball cards? Mrs. Levitt asked. Yeah, well, sort of. She went to check her desk, reached into the drawer, and handed me 4 tickets to Kentucky Kingdom. Chapter 19, A New Ball Game. Well, 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 Bobby Fuller sneered as I stepped up to the plate. Look who's back, Stoshak the Polak. I had been suspended for most of the season because of the riot I had started. My team, the Yellow Jackets, had done pretty well without me. They finished the season tied for first place with Fuller's team. We were playing a 1-game playoff to see who could call themselves the champions of the Louisville Little League. The president of the league had lifted my suspension so I could play in the final game. But Coach Hutchinson was still mad at me, so he didn't put me in the starting lineup. Somebody reminded him that a league rule states everybody on the bench has to play at least 1 inning. So Coach Hutchinson had no choice but to put me in the game. The score was tied at 6-6 in the bottom of the 6th inning. We had 2 outs when Coach Hutchinson finally decided to put me in as a pinch hitter. How cool would it be, I thought, to slam a home run off Bobby Fuller right now? That would totally humiliate him and win the championship for us in 1 swing of the bat. Man, if I did that, Fuller might as well get a shovel and dig his own grave right on the pitcher's mound. Life as he knew it would be over. The big, dumb, ugly Polak is back, Fuller laughed, looking in for the sign. Did you enjoy your vacation? He wound up and threw his hard one right at my head. Instinctively, my legs crumpled to pull my head out of the line of fire. Fuller laughed as my bat flew up in the air and hit me on the arm. The umpire gave Fuller a warning and helped me to my feet. Oops, Fuller smirked. That one slipped. You're going to let him get away with that? The catcher whispered to me. Why don't you go out there and show him who's boss? Yeah, I could do that, but it wouldn't put a run on the scoreboard. I see you have the guts to throw the ball at my head, I yelled to Fuller. Do you have the guts to throw it over the plate? You saying I'm gutless? Fuller shot back. You heard me, I shouted. You know you can't get me out fair and square. You were afraid to pitch to me. I could come over there and break your face, Doshak. Yeah, that would be another way to avoid pitching to me. Fuller stomped around the mound, thinking things over.
Cut out the trash talk, boys, the umpire hollered. Your mommies don't want to hear that stuff.
I knew Fuller was going to throw a slow curve over the outside corner, and he did. I flicked the bat at it and sent it up the middle. If he had merely stuck his glove in front of his face, he would have caught the ball and the game would be over. But Fuller ducked to get out of the way. The coward. The ball skipped over the second base bag and into center field. Fuller was steaming. I took the lead at first base. He looked at me, and I stuck my tongue out at him. I'm going to steal, I teased him, and there's nothing you can do to stop me. Fuller threw over to first, almost throwing the ball away. I jumped right back up and extended my lead a little further. He didn't want me to reach second, I knew, because I could score on a single from there. Fuller wheeled around quickly and threw to first, trying to catch me off base. I didn't hesitate. Instead of diving back to the bag, I broke for second. Seeing me run the other way must have thrown him off. His throw to first went wild. It sailed over the first baseman's head and into the crowd. I was already past second, and the umpire said I could advance to third on the overthrow. If Fuller had been a volcano, he would have erupted. His infielders gathered around to try and calm him down, but it was hopeless. They needed a tranquilizer gun. Bobby, I called sweetly from third base. Oh, Bobby, it's me, your worst nightmare. You know, the dumb Polak. I'm gonna steal home now. Don't think I won't try. Stealing home, I know, is one of the most risky, physically dangerous, and exciting plays in baseball. No human being can run as fast as the slowest pitch. The odds are against the runner. That's why hardly anybody ever does it. But if you can get a good jump, a bad pitch, and a little luck, you can pull it off. I knew I would have my best chance on the first pitch. If I let him throw a few pitches over the plate, he might regain control of himself, and I'd lose my advantage. He threw over to third a couple of times. That gave me a pretty good look at his pickoff move. As he peered in for the sign, I could tell he wasn't going to throw over again. He was concentrating on the batter. As soon as he brought the ball over his head to begin his windup, I broke for the plate. I didn't look over at him after that. It would just slow me down. It was a race between me and the ball. The catcher saw me coming home and was bracing himself for the play at the plate. The ball wasn't there yet, so I had a good chance to beat it, or at least knock it out of the catcher's hand. 10 feet from the plate, I started my slide, leaving my feet and extending my right toe in front of me. The pitch must have been a little high, because the catcher stood up to snare it. I heard it smack against his mitt. He brought the mitt down on me, and we tumbled across the plate together. I thought I was in there, but you never know how the umpire is going to see things. "Safe!" called the ump. The Yellow Jackets were all over me before I could even get up. Everybody was yelling and screaming and pounding me on the back. I hadn't been in a pileup like that since the riot I started before the season. When everything had settled down, Coach Hutchinson came over and wrapped an arm around me. "Where did you learn to play like that?" "Coach," I said, "you wouldn't believe me. Not in a million years." The end. All right, there's a little thing at the end that I want to read to you. To the reader. It's very interesting. Joe Stoshak is a fictional character, but the world he moved through in 1947 was true. Mostly true, anyway. The names of streets, players, movies, and baseball events described in this book are accurate. A few things had to be changed or moved in time. For instance, Dixie Walker circulated his petition during spring training, not on opening day. Al Gianfrido didn't join the Dodgers until May. The Roswell UFO incident took place in June, not March. The real name of the Dodgers bat boy was Charlie DiGiovanna, and he was not bigoted or crazy. The facts about Jackie Robinson came from many biographies, especially the ones written by Jules Tigel and Maury Allen. Pete Golenbach's Bums, an Oral History of the Brooklyn Dodgers, was also very helpful. To get the flavor of Brooklyn in the 40s, Elliot Wolensky's When Brooklyn Was the World and It Happened in Brooklyn by Harvey and Myrna Katz were indispensable. Jackie Robinson's first year in the big leagues was even more difficult than described here. He came close to suffering a breakdown at one point, and once during the season, his sister had to talk him out of abandoning the experiment. Luckily for all of us, he didn't. At the end of the 1947 season, Jackie was named the second most popular man in the United States, behind Bing Crosby. His teammate, Dixie Walker, who requested a trade rather than play alongside a black man, changed his mind and asked to stay with the Dodgers. It was too late. He was traded to the Pittsburgh Pirates after the season. The Dodgers also released Al Gianfrido. The game in which he made his famous catch was the last of his career. 2 years later, Jackie Robinson had his best season. He led the league with a .342 average and won the Most Valuable Player Award. During Jackie's 10 years on the team, the Brooklyn Dodgers won the National League pennant in 1947, 1949, 1952, 1953, 1955, and 1956. Each time, they played the Yankees in a Subway Series. They lost every year, except once, 1955. All of Brooklyn rejoiced. 2 years after winning that one World Series, the Dodger management broke hearts all over New York when they moved the team to Los Angeles. Ebbets Field was demolished in 1960, and turned into a 23-story apartment building. Jackie Robinson, almost single-handedly, was the symbol for civil rights in America in the 1940s. Martin Luther King was just 18 years old in 1947. 1 year after Jackie broke the color barrier, President Truman initiated desegregation of the armed forces. In 1950, the Supreme Court ended segregation on trains and in colleges. In 1954, they made school segregation illegal. In baseball, African American players were slowly signed by other teams. It wasn't until 12 years after Robinson's breakthrough that every team in the majors had signed at least one black player. It wasn't until 1966 that Emmett Ashford, the first black umpire, was hired. It wasn't until 1975 that Frank Robinson became the first black manager. One of the sad and forgotten parts of the Jackie Robinson story is that breaking the color barrier signaled the end of the Negro Leagues. After the best black players had been snapped up by the major leagues, all black teams folded one after the other. Dan Bankhead was never beaten up in an alley, but he was a real person. He was Jackie Robinson's teammate, roommate, and the first pitcher to break the color barrier. He died in 1976. Many of Jackie Robinson's other teammates are no longer with us. Hugh Casey died in 1951, Bruce Edwards in 1975, Pete Reiser in 1981, Dixie Walker in 1982, Joe Hatton in 1988, Carl Ferrillo in 1989, and Cookie Lavigetto in 1990. Branch Rickey, the Dodger general manager who had the courage to bring Jackie Robinson to the majors, died in 1965. Babe Ruth was in attendance at the 1947 World Series. It was his last. He died 10 months later. During Jackie Robinson's baseball career, Rachel Robinson had two more children, enrolled in a program in psychiatric nursing at New York University, and became a teacher at the Yale School of Nursing. Today, she runs the Jackie Robinson Foundation. Jackie Jr. struggled to grow up in the shadow of his famous father. While fighting in Vietnam, he became addicted to alcohol and drugs. He went through a successful rehabilitation, but died in an automobile accident in 1971. He was just 24. After he left baseball, Jackie Robinson became an executive and a civil rights activist. He developed diabetes and other health problems at a very young age. Jackie just seemed to get older faster than the rest of us, Pee Wee Reese told Maury Allen in his book, Jackie Robinson, A Life Remembered. It had to be what he went through. I don't think Jackie ever stopped carrying that burden. I'm no doctor, but I'm sure it cut his life short. Jackie Robinson could never stop fighting. Jackie Robinson died at the age of 53 on October 24th, 1972. He is buried in Cypress Hills Cemetery in Brooklyn. The end. Such a great book. Tomorrow we begin a new book. A totally new book. And I hope you like mysteries because it's a mystery. And I'm going to leave the mystery until tomorrow to tell you what the book is. So come back and have a lovely afternoon and evening or whenever you're listening. And I hope I'll see you tomorrow.